Welcome to the Why Isn't It Working? Business and Tech Podcast, talking all things business and tech in the emerging and enterprise space. Here are your hosts, Carl Wood and Michael Hamilton.
Okay, welcome to the podcast. Today we have Dave Gardner from Carthoto Capital and a seasonal investor. How are you going today, Dave?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Michael. Yourself?
Oh, very good. And hello, Carl. How are you?
Michael, lovely to see you as always. And Dave, thank you very much for joining us today as well. It's an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure, Carl. It's been a few years since we saw each other on a rugby field.
I think so. It has indeed. So Dave, tell us about that journey. I mean, obviously, you know, you're a man, I guess, like us who doesn't really, you know, sit still, so to speak, in one position for too long. So what was your journey onto becoming, you know, into the VC world? How did that happen?
Totally by accident, as most things in life seem to happen. My original background, obviously I'm British originally, was an engineer out of uni, worked in various industries, worked in oil, worked in chocolate, so both types of liquid gold, you could say. And then got into sort of more sort of management, supply chain and IT sort of management in the back half of my career in the UK. And then the dream, I still had the dream to get to Australia and emigrated out here in 2000. Had no work, didn't have a job, so took whatever came first, and that was a management consulting position at A.T. Kearney. Never done that before, new to me, loved the work, wasn't so keen on the big sort of global company. So I actually started a business called Portland Group in 2002 with a friend I was introduced to, and we built a consulting and managed services business specializing in procurement and supply chain for about 10 years, and sold that in 2012 to Infosys, the Indian IT tech company. Spent a couple of years sort of working out my time there. And in that period, because I'd been on this startup journey myself and had a successful exit, a few friends had reached out to me who had their own startups and they were sort of, you know, they were looking for help, advice. Some of them were looking for money, of course. And so I started being an angel investor. And that you know, I got to meet a whole bunch of other angel investors. A group of us sort of got on pretty well. And in 2014, we all decided that, you know, we should actually do it, you know, do it more formally, do it properly. We were all, you know, doing different things and not really having a big influence over the companies we were investing in. So we created a venture capital company, Carthoto Capital, and started that sort of back half of 2014. Six partners, all very different backgrounds. You know, my background's more sort of operational supply chain consulting. Some other guys come out of straight finance, another one out of consulting, actually, one out of venture capital before Carthoto. So good range of skills. And we decided we were going to focus on the startup end of venture capital. We thought Australia was very weak in that area at that time. It was kind of our passion. That's the area we really get excited about, is finding opportunities, helping the founders grow a real business from scratch. We started the business, started investing, started looking for opportunities, you know, made some very interesting early investments, which we can talk about later. Some of which were successful, some which weren't. And, you know, over the last 6 years, we've built that business up into, you know, a portfolio of about 30 investments. We've had several exits, some pretty successful. Of course, we've had some failures as well, as you do in our space. And we've got a whole bunch of, you know, relatively recent investments that look promising. And we've moved from a model of investing our own money alongside high net worths in each deal. And we've now been able to raise funds both from high net worths and also from a super company to allow us to, you know, really speed up that investment process. So we can deploy those funds more quickly and more easily now. as we progress the business. So that's my journey. You know, just it wasn't a plan to be in venture capital, but it kind of happened, and I'm very glad it did, because it's a really interesting, exciting area to be involved in.
Well, I think we're also glad you got into that as well, because like you said, the VC community has been, I guess, like at the time you guys got into it, fairly immature. And the interesting part being that 98% of business in Australia is small business. It is technically almost a startup phase. Most businesses don't even make it past that. So do you see that now changing? I mean, is there obviously with, you know, the startup model coming out of the States becoming, I guess, more refined than it has been previously? Do you see that starting to shift a little bit within Australia, or are most companies just looking for overseas straight away prior to looking locally?
It's definitely in change. There's definitely more money and more, there's more venture capitalists and more money in Australia in that sector than there were 6 years ago. It's still, I would still call it fairly immature. There's by no means the capacity to meet all the needs in the market. So you're absolutely right. An awful lot of startups, you know, that sort of early stage seed, maybe, you know, that round, A round, they're going overseas. They're having to look overseas as well as in Australia for funding. And I think that will continue. While there are, you know, while there is more money in the sector, I still don't think there's enough to cover, provide everybody that's looking for funding with what they need. So I think that will continue, but since matured, there's you know, there's probably, I don't know, 10 to 15 venture capital businesses now in Australia that sort of operate in that startup early stage space. So there's a lot more options than there were 6 years ago.
Fantastic. And what are you finding in Australia? I know from the conversations I've had last 10 years or so, a lot of investors do like their property and versus putting into a startup or something like that. Is that the type of immaturity, or not necessarily immaturity that you're seeing, or is it just appetite for risk?
I think Australian business is very conservative. So I think just as a general rule of thumb, you know, across, you know, I've seen an awful lot of Australian business through my consulting experience as well. And Australian business people tend to be conservative because they I guess they can afford to be, right? In Australia, there's so many, we're so lucky, there's so many opportunities to invest money, to protect our money. The country's growing, the economy is healthy. People don't feel the need to take risk to make returns. Mm. And that goes from the corporate end of the country all the way down through to the startup end and to investors. So, but I think what's really changed is obviously the returns that investors are getting from the typical sort of safe havens, you know, your term deposit and the like, obviously have dropped dramatically in that period. And so, you know, what we've seen is obviously there's a lot more people looking for higher returns, and they're now starting to consider things that maybe they would have thought too risky in the past. And I think that goes for both individual investors, but also the institutional investors. So, you know, the superannuation funds have now started putting money into venture capital because they can't generate the returns they've promised their, you know, their investors effectively on their super money by doing the traditional things they've done. So it has helped. It has given the sector more access to capital. Our high net worth, when I think about the high net worths who've invested alongside us, they were already there. You know, they understand that when you invest, there's probably a range of risk you want to take with your money. And they've said, well, I'm going to put 30% of my money in term deposit, gold, whatever you want to call it, a third in stocks and shares, and another and property, and another third is going to be my, you know, the play money that if I lose it all, it doesn't matter, but I'll put it into something more high risk, potentially a higher return. And those, you know, those guys have been around a long time and they've thought that through carefully. And those are the types of high net worths that, you know, would invest alongside us in some of these early stage companies. So yeah, it's constantly changing, but there's definitely more capital in the system now than there was. And that's partly because of macroeconomic reasons and partly because, you know, people are just more aware of this sector and the opportunities in this space.
Had you believed the pandemic has changed your opinion or changed your strategy at all, or is it still
the same plan? I think it's probably slowed. It's slowed some things down. When you talk about raising capital, particularly in the early days in Australia where we had the full-on lockdown, and people didn't really, you know, the share market went into nosedive. People really weren't sure what was going to happen. Clearly, those few months, things raising money was extremely difficult, both for the startups and for, you know, any kind of venture capital business. But that's, I think that's now changing. People are realizing there's life after COVID. Obviously, Australia's done pretty well in managing so far. And the economy is, you know, doing okay. Obviously, there's a lot of damage in certain sectors, but generally it's not doing too badly. So we're not finding, we're certainly seeing there's still lots of startups that need funding. That hasn't changed. But it's probably just a bit slower, the actual process of going through the selection and making an investment, raising money for a new fund. Those things, I think, have all slowed down a bit because of what's happened.
One of the other big trends that's been starting to spike in the last couple of years, and we've spoken about the high net worth individuals, Dave, and I guess for people who aren't in that bracket, things like crowdfunding and crowdsourcing, where you can sort of take a smaller chunk of cash of your own and invest it into some alternatives, have also started to rise, and that sort of access to the platforms that manage that as well. So I think I've seen a couple in Australia, like Birchall and those sort of ones, but that's still quite relatively a new concept in Australia as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's not something I know a massive amount about, but I do know some startups who very successfully raise money through crowdfunding. And if you're in that kind of business, you know, where it's a consumer product that people can instantly connect with and feel that they want to be part of, then it's a great way. I think it's a great way to raise money and get you started. So. Yeah, I think it's the same as in our space. It's several years behind the US and perhaps parts of Europe, but catching up.
And for yourself, within the group, within Carthona, so you were saying before, you know, sometimes there's not always a general consensus on the right things to sort of choose. So what happens in that sort of process? You know, is it fairly democratic? Is it, you know, is it sort of whoever's got the loudest voice? How does that often work with you guys?
Yeah, look,
without going too much obviously into it.
It's definitely a benevolent dictatorship, I would describe it as. James and Dean, who are the principals in the business, they're the guys that work full-time in the business, the partners. They make the final call. So at the end of the day, you know, we can debate investments as a team, which happens on a weekly basis. But, they, you know, if they're not on board, then it's not going to happen. And that's good. That's actually a good thing because they are spending 24 hours by 7 thinking about our investments as Carthona. Most of the other partners, like myself, we have other interests outside of Carthona. So although we play a role in making those decisions, then it's right that those two guys are the guys that really, at the end of the day, make the call. But, you know, everyone listens to each other. It's all debated. It's all healthy, good, healthy arguments. And that way you get a better decision, obviously, if you have that kind of input from all sides.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing was that there's a lot of misconception, I guess, from people that, you know, investment is simply just providing the funds and then, you know, tracking the progress. But in a lot of cases, it's actually the connections, the network and the management expertise that need to be, you know, injected into that investment to help it to grow. So, I mean, that's obviously the case with yourself, because like you said earlier, you're actually on board now with an investment to help them drive to that next step. So,
I'm living that journey right now. I mean, I'm acting CEO at one of our investments, because unfortunately one of the founders had to depart when we went into COVID. And so I've taken over the reins, and that's just an example of the way we approach our investments, which is hands-on. We believe when you're investing in companies this young, you need to act like you're another part of the executive team. because A, they need the help. There's never enough arms and legs in a young business to cover all the bases. And B, hopefully there's a lot of expertise we can bring to the table. And that could be our networks, you know, it could be introductions to the right people. It could be helping them open up sales channels. It could be thinking through the strategy for the business. It could be looking at different technologies that they might be looking to adopt. It could be HR, you know, these companies are all about people, like any business, and their success or failure usually doesn't depend on their product or their technology, but actually their people. And so we spend a lot of time, you know, coaching, supporting our founders along that journey of hiring the right people, creating the right structures in their business for success for their teams. Because that's probably the single biggest point of failure in startup is getting the wrong people or the wrong team structure happening.
Yep.
And what sort of businesses are you looking for in Australia? Like, you know, what makes a good investment here?
Well, look, our mandate is it has to be technology based. Is our sort of starting point. So we don't invest in, you know, manufacturing businesses, product businesses, service, you know, serve just pure services businesses. So there has to be a large technology component is the first thing that we look for. And then, you know, we're less focused on B2B and SaaS. We don't do a lot of B2B and SaaS investments. And that's just because of most of the partners don't have sort of experience in that area, don't feel they can add a lot of value to it. Interestingly, it's an area I know more about. And so I invest outside of Carthona in some of those opportunities because, you know, with my background, obviously, you know, I know a lot about selling B2B and also about supply chain procurement operations sort of opportunities within corporates and SMEs. So the mandate's pretty clear. We have sort of areas of interest that change from time to time. So, you know, in the past we've had a focus on virtual reality. So that's how we ended up with zero latency in the portfolio. We've had a focus on autonomous vehicles, which is how we've ended up with, you know, Ouster and D'Adelin in their portfolio. We've obviously got a fintech focus because a couple of guys very experienced in that space, and we've got a number of fintech investments, and we even had an exit in one of those. So we sort of go through, you know, each year there might be a slightly different focus where we go out looking, actively looking for opportunities to invest in. And obviously at the same time, we're also getting, you know, it can be 20 to 30 approaches each week. From startups looking for investment. So we have to have a pretty efficient pipeline management process to review all of those and actually do them justice and pick out the ones that, you know, might either meet one of our, you know, focuses or you know, just look really interesting for one reason or another.
So flipping that on its head, what are some of the things that, you know, obviously you have a lot of applications from startups, but what are some of the common trends where they just miss the mark? Like they might have a good product, but they just, you know, it's just not something that you guys want to move forward with. The way they present, the way they're structured, their vision. Gosh. I mean, is it a difficult one to answer?
A really difficult one, but a lot of the time it comes down to the people.
Yep.
You've got to invest in people that you want to work with. And that can just be purely the chemistry. You know, none of us, we know from hard experience that you can invest in a company with a great product and a great technology. But if you don't get on, you don't meet eye to eye on the way to, on the sort of more the philosophy of running a business, that's going to end in, you know, painful ending. So I think a huge amount of it is down to the founders. And I say founders because that's another thing we've learned and we try and look for is companies that have multiple founders. because we think that we've just seen that that's a more successful model and a healthier model for startups. We've seen it's very hard for an individual to drive a business from startup through to success. At some point, they're going to need, you know, a second or third partner to really take the load and to help make good decisions, because it's so difficult for an individual to always make the right decision. So that's, you know, that's another factor that we would look for. And then obviously the way, you know, the way they present themselves, the way they present the opportunity is also important, because a lot of the time we only get to see, we might speak to them on the phone or Zoom, and we might see we'll see a deck, right? And based on that, we have to make a decision. You can't do it any other way. When you're dealing with 20 to 30 a week, you can't meet them all. You can't, you know, do a deep dive, look at their market. So you've got to base your decision on, you know, those limited factors. And obviously the way they present their business is actually quite important in that process. And just being very clear about the first biggest turnoff for us is when we don't know what problem they're solving. If you can't work out, there's so many businesses we get approached by, they just fail to explain what problem they're solving. And if you can't get that across, then it's very hard to then convince somebody that you've got a business that's worth investing in.
And particularly from not being in the industry that what that problem is trying to solve, they are trying to be in or build a product and not doing enough research. Do you find that's a quite a common factor?
There is some of that, of course. A lot of people that we see have just thought of a good idea and said, right, I'm going to go and do it. And they haven't, you're right, they haven't done the market research or really tested it with enough people in that sector to sort of really know whether it's a winner or not, whether they're really solving a problem for somebody. But I also think just people are very poor at explaining the problem they're solving, because sometimes they're just so close to it. They just think it's so obvious to them that everyone else understands or gets it. And so they just very poorly explain the problem that they're really trying to fix. And that's as much a problem as not having done the groundwork in the first place.
Fantastic. Because I know in the USA, there's a lot of venture capital funds. Obviously, the money's huge there, but they get around an industry problem and they are dedicated to that. Is that a model we should be adopting in the future here more often, or is this not enough system, as you mentioned before?
I think in the Australian market, there are some specialised venture capital funds. You know, there are some that look only at medical area. That's a very specialised area, long lead times. You've got to have a different approach to that. Probably the Australian market isn't big enough to create the kind of specialization you see in the US. Is probably the reality of it. I think you look at the types of investments that we make versus some of our other venture capital firms in Australia. There are obvious themes and obvious areas of interest that differ between them. So in some ways, that we're partly down that model, but I don't think there's the depth of the number of businesses and the depth of the size of markets to probably support that specialization that you see in the US, is my view.
Is that something, a more of a government role, federal government role, to expand that out, make it more of a national interest agenda going forward, or is it just getting heightened?
I think it's my view, you know, we all have different philosophical views on government getting involved in business and particularly in startups. I think the less they're involved in forcing certain structures in the industry is probably better. But certainly in terms of providing the support for startups, then whether that be financial or other means, then they can play an important role. And, you know, it's been good. You know, for example, the R&D offset that that they were really pulling back on in the last sort of 18 months, 2 years, they've now, you know, as part of the latest announcements of their from the budget, they're actually going to keep that as it was effectively for the smaller sort of startup end of, which is a really important incentive for and support for startup technology companies.
Well, interestingly enough, there was an article yesterday, actually, where I think the federal government's currently looking at assessments for overseas organizations who want to invest into Australia. And there's been quite a bit of a few startups that have said, hey, hang on a minute. We've got companies like Sequoia Capital and a lot of the other big US ones who have a heavy portfolio in here. That's going to now make it harder for them to actually access funds directly from, you know, their previous lenders as well.
I mean, that will only impact a small part of the market because it's only startups who have something that's of, you know, national importance in terms of security. So, you know, if you're in, you know, something where defense are interested, I think the examples were something to do with quantum computing.
Yeah, quantum computing and cybersecurity, I think, now where they're looking to roll that out potentially at federal level,
Then, there, of course, there is a potential that things could get held up if it has to get sent to the, Foreign Intervention Relations Board or the Foreign Investment Board, isn't it, that they review in government. You know, that process can go for months, and that's not going to work for startups who need investment seeds. So I think, and you know, I don't think anyone knows quite where that's going to end up. And it's, but it is things like that that governments do, but they're not really aware of the impact on this sector. It works for the big end of town. That's fine. They can wait a few months for a decision to come through. But for a startup who may only have, you know, 3 months left of cash, they can't wait. They need to get that investment on board, you know, now, in order to survive and to build. I guess that's the bit that's missing is there does seem to be a bit of a blind spot in government still in Australia around the startup sector. There doesn't seem to be a lot of I think maybe Malcolm Turnbull was a bit more onto it and there was a bit more support when he was Prime Minister, but I don't see much focus on this sector from the Australian government right now. Not to say that there is support, you know, things like the Accelerating Commercialization Grant, the R&D tax offset, they're all good things that support quite a lot of young businesses. But, you know, decisions seem to get made at a sort of high level that people haven't thought through the consequences for that, for this sector lower down.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I guess, like you said before, it's probably a case where people will just look straight if they do have something straight overseas, and then, you know, there's no benefits to then be reaped by the government. So it's kind of this catch-22 where, yes, we've got programs. They're in certain spaces though, Michael. I mean, I believe if I look at things around R&D grants, tax offsets, a lot of it is based around things like agriculture, mining sector as well. Surprise, surprise. But for pure technology problems, again, if you're unable to articulate how it fits into those sectors, then you're probably not going to qualify for a lot of these R&D grants as well. So I guess, like, it comes back to your point before, Dave, if you're ambiguous on the problem you're trying to solve, then it's not going to get you very far. You know, it has to be a clear problem with a clear technical outcome and easily explainable to someone who's not in that industry. Because like you said, if you as an investor get, you know, 20, 30, up to 100 applications a week, you're not going to have time to sift through and go, right, I need to look at everything in minute detail. So it has to be explained in pure English, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And look, just coming back to government support, I mean, at the end of the day, these businesses have got to survive in their own right. They've got to stand on their own two feet. Yeah. And I think there's a danger that you end up with this kind of, it's almost like being on welfare, you know, you end up with this dependence almost, and you end up with businesses that really shouldn't exist in some cases. So there's a fine line between providing enough support to encourage the sector, but also encouraging, it's healthy that businesses fail in this sector. You know, the numbers are scary, right? It's only something like 2 out of 10 startups actually, you know, are still going 5 years later. So, but that's a good thing because it's the ideas, you know, the ideas happen, and people test them, and some of them work, and that's great, and some of them don't. And so they, a lot of these, you know, all these entrepreneurs, most of them are have gone multiple times around this journey. They've tried something, it didn't work. They've tried something else, maybe that didn't work. And then the third or fourth time, they actually find, you know, something that really solves the problem. And that's when they hit success. So in some ways, it's a bit like this whole argument about JobKeeper, right? And the zombie companies. It's exactly the same discussion. Is, you know, should you keep JobKeeper because lots of people are going to be out of work, or should you remove it because it's just keeping a whole load of companies, you know, going that shouldn't really survive? And what's better? I mean, you know, I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, that's a tricky one, isn't it? Like, do you take the walloping now, or do you wait, and does the walloping get bigger down the road? That's a tricky one.
It's hard, but ultimately, it is. I think it is healthy to have a even playing field on which companies fail or flourish.
Yeah. Well, that is an interesting point, because, I mean, like you said, before the sort of startup mentality came to mind, if you were to start a small business, basically you were grabbing your savings, you were leveraging your house, you were doing whatever it took and backing yourself to go forward. Now, like you said, there was a success and failure rate, but there was no dependency or trickle of Series A, Series B, whatever it might be, to push you to the next stages.
Yes.
So in many ways, has that created a mentality within some entrepreneurs where, you know, they are simply reliant and not willing to put their own money into some cases, but, you know, coming back for investment again?
I think, yeah, there are certainly some startups that I come across where, when I really get into the detail of discussing with them what money they need versus what they would like to have, It soon becomes obvious to them and to me that they should really fund it themselves for longer. Yeah. Because it's all about timing. It's about, you know, it's how capital intensive is their particular business going to be? Have they reached the point where they've tested the market enough to be sure that they're solving a real problem? Oftentimes we say to startups, no, just go away. Don't take any money just yet. Spend a bit more time just understanding your market, refining your product, and then it's worth spending money on this once you've really got that nailed. So I think there's, you know, there is a bit of that where people have an idea and they go straight to potential funders to raise, you know, $3 or $4 million to do something, but they haven't really thought through what it is they want to do. And so you can very quickly waste that $3 or $4 million and be in a really bad position with your investor and also with your business. Whereas in some cases, it's better to actually do things a little bit more slowly and more considered, and perhaps without that external investment early, in order to test the idea and get it to a point where you're confident that, you know, it's actually going to be successful. There is an element of that, but then I would never take away from the founders we have the investment they have made, both emotionally and financially, in their business is immense in all cases, you know, regardless of whether they mortgage their house or whatever they might have done to get started. They are almost in all cases, they're giving up, you know, healthy salaries. They're usually people who've had a career already that have come out of, you know, some sort of corporate environment or, you know, some other startup where they've done well, and they really are taking a big backward step in earning and a big upward step in hours in order to, you know, build their business. So, you know, I think if you want to do a startup, you've got to be, you know, 100% committed, and the successful startups are like that. They're pretty amazing people.
Yeah. And I guess being in the similar industry or something you're familiar with, like you said, if you've come from a career in one particular area and you've got a really, really deep understanding of the problems in that area that you think you can then take in, it's going to make it easier than, say, me going, hey, I got a great idea for the restaurant industry, which, you know, I worked in maybe for 2 years back in 98, you know, and there's not that sort of, you know, direct lineage from what your experience has been to the problem to the passion as well. And I guess that's the other thing that, you know, you spoke a lot about, Dave, is that if there is no passion, then, you know, if there's no drive, then, you know, what's the next step really? I mean, it's not something that I would personally invest in, but I think that person didn't have the passion either.
Yeah, no, you're right. And it's interesting. And when I look at the individuals we've backed, if you looked at average age, it's probably mid 30s, which you might think is a bit of a surprise for startups, but it just reflects the fact that the people who've got that knowledge of their industry or sector that they're then solving a problem for is really important. And that little bit of, you know, sometimes a little bit of maturity helps as well when you're building a business. But it's not to say we haven't invested in companies with, you know, people in their early 20s. That happens, of course. But we do have quite a number of companies where the entrepreneurs have actually been in their, you know, early 50s, because you need that experience to understand the problem and know how to build a solution and have the relationships then to build a business around it.
What about your big, like looking at the big winners you've had, is it like solving a really decent problem in particular industry? What's been the big winners for you?
Well, look, I mean, the two sort of big exits we've had have been Credible and Sparesbox. Both very different kinds of businesses. Credible is basically a financial product broking platform based in the US, and an Australian entrepreneur, which is how we ended up backing that business. I would say that, you know, it's just it's the holy trinity. It's a really good entrepreneur solving a problem, a real business problem, and timing is right. You know, those are the three things I think to be successful. So, you know, Dashi is the most incredible entrepreneur. The guy's a machine, and he's so smart, and he's built such a great business. The American market was ready for their product, so they started with student loan refinancing, and it was just after the American government allowed the nationalized loans to be refinanced into the private sector. So there's a lot of opportunity to grab space in that sector. And then, you know, timing was just perfect. It just, you know, that legislation had just been enforced for sort of 18 months when they started the business. So it was just perfect. Everyone was looking at this, thinking about how they could refinance their loans and reduce their payments. And that's what really kickstarted that business. So, you know, that was success there. The other business, Sparesbox, very different. That's a online retail business. They do, they're basically online retail for car nuts. So, you know, if you've got your prized Ute or Holden, and you spend the whole weekend tinkering under the bonnet, then you probably go to Sparesbox to order your parts. And that business, again, was about people. Great team, great leadership team there. It was about opportunity. You know, nobody, the big brands like the Repcos and the Super Cheap Autos, their online offering was just an afterthought. It's a classic, you know, old style shop network that just sort of basically put a catalog onto the internet and think that people are going to buy from there. So there was very little competition. So good timing, opportunity, and you know, they've proven that, and you know, they've actually, obviously, they got bought by the parent company of Repco, interestingly enough, and they've become effectively Repco's, you know, online part of their business.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You know what? And we're finding the last couple of podcasts, Carl and I, we're talking to our guests, and we talked a lot about data obviously, and emerging industries and so forth. What's the future look like for you for emerging industries like IoT or blockchain or, you know, data, you know, AI and so forth? Is there anything that's, you know, making you excited?
I guess one of the company I'm involved in outside of Carthona is a company called RoboBuy. And they are combining that AI and big data into their solution to basically automate the process of procurement for large corporates. So really, really sort of, you know, big data sets, you know, you can imagine a corporation spend billions of dollars on their supplies, whether it's products or services or whatever it might be. There's billions and billions of dollars that these big companies buy. It's amazing how little insight they actually have into what they're buying. And therefore, you know, information is you know, is key, right, in making good decisions. And so, you know, guess what? They don't make the right decisions a lot of the time around how they buy, what they buy, who they buy from. And and this business is solving that through the use of AI, which is analyzing all their purchases all the time, every day, and then suggesting opportunities to the business to enable them to make good decisions. And you know, you just we're seeing that across the board, that this technology is maturing to the point where it's actually, it's not just about providing a dashboard with some, you know, we've seen the classic dashboards with the charts and the fancy charts, and you can dive into the, you can dive through the charts down into the data. It's actually telling you what to do. So it's bringing intelligence into the decision making, not just providing you with, you know, the data that you might make a decision with at some point. It's actually telling you what to do based on having analyzed all that data and used, you know, whether it's artificial intelligence, machine learning, whatever you want to call it, to tell you, you know, what's the best course of action here.
That's good. So, okay. That's awesome. And also, are the skill sets for these businesses when they access that data type AI people from the universities or to hire them in, are they in Australia or do they have to go overseas to bring it in, or is it all done?
Yeah, it's a real problem in Australia. Getting, as we all know, finding good quality technical resource is really hard. Anyone who's good can just, you know, name their price. So yes, a lot of work is done offshore. For example, that RoboBuy business, almost all that, you know, they've got some tech team. I think the model I like is where you have some, you know, the core of the tech team are onshore and they're really connected to the business and the problem you're trying to solve and to the customer. But the sort of, you know, the people, the data analysts and the programmers can be anywhere in the world because that's just practical, both from getting the skills, but also doing the work at a cost that makes sense. So, you know, RoboBuy is just like that. They've got their CTO is based here. He's got a small team of architects and other senior IT people here. And then there's a team of, you know, 35 programmers, data analysts, AI experts, over in India, in this case, who do the bulk of the work, but under the guidance and the strategic direction of the team that are onshore. And that model. So you know, when we're investing and we look at a business, we want them to have the technology know-how sitting within the business.
Yeah.
And particularly, obviously, the CTO, CIO needs to understand and have that. But we don't really insist that they have to have all their resources in this country, or, you know, it's really a question of, we understand that that's just not practical in many cases. You just couldn't build a team with the availability of resources in Australia.
That's definitely a big one. Yeah,
okay. It's interesting. It is another common theme that, like, you know, but I mean, for a lot of startups, like you said, I mean, COVID's probably exposed it more, that, you know, there's less of a reliance on people to be nearby and people have had to adapt and work, you know, collaboratively in separate environments. But in addition to that, and we know it from experience, and I've had to go overseas for my development, you know, building applications, because either their skill sets, all the skill sets are now here, but the expense for a startup is, you know, quite high as well. So, but if you can balance having the smarts driven from Australia with development from other regions, depending on what your intent or technology is, then I think, you know, you do have the recipe to build something, you know, very efficiently on that regard as well.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it's not easy, right? There are so many horror stories as well about going offshore and outsourcing your tech to third party. It all comes down to having good systems and management onshore that actually know how to manage that process, because otherwise it can all go horribly wrong as well. I've seen disasters in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. IP leakage. But yeah. I think that also comes down to what you said before, Dave. I mean, people here really need to build and test it out themselves first before then deciding to scale it into, you know, so-called mass production from a technology standpoint. Because if you do outsource, then you don't have that trust, or you don't have that direct connection with the person who's doing it on your behalf, then you don't have real control. I mean, you can sort of, you know, make sure your features are getting built, but you don't know who's building it, who's seeing your code, who has, you know, nefarious actions. It becomes very much a black box for you as well. So that's the hard part,
yeah,
of control.
Yeah. And look, and if you're not clear about what you want to build, you'll get what you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
You'll have something you weren't expecting.
Oh God, my brother works for a company wholesaler, so they used to deal directly with the factories over in China, and they gave them the shirt design, and it came back 40-foot container, and not a single one had buttons on it, and it was supposed to be, you know, a nice button-up shirt. And they said, "What's going on?" They said, "Well, no, you didn't say buttons, so you get what you get." So I think you're exactly right when it comes to something like that. Michael, do we have any more questions for David on your behalf? I know.
We've gone for a fair bit today. It's been great. Dave's knowledge has been outstanding. And look, obviously, going to Carthona or going to Dave, you get that expertise and knowledge of what to do, you know, not just get the money and what people think it is, but you get a lot of quality experience and good advice that comes with it. Great.
Absolutely. And we'll be providing Dave's details on the footer at the end of the podcast, as well as Carthona Capital, so you guys can all check it out. They've got some really, really cool stuff in the portfolio. I mean, looking through it before, Dave, there was some really awesome stuff around the, you know, the financial sector. You've got like Deferit, which is a really exciting product, I think. You know, companies like Afterpay and Zip are starting to come there, but Deferit's much more specialized in the bill space. It looks like a fantastic idea. Like you said, you've also got Dayadlin.
Yeah. It's a bit of a nightmare, that one.
But, you know, the interesting thing was, I found that not just on practical use for AI in the automotive space, but also aircraft as well.
Yes.
So that's really interesting, you know. And I know companies like Qantas have used AI to do predictive flight programming to help them save on fuel and pilot fatigue too. So that's a really interesting component, I think, as well. So definitely some really, really cool stuff in the portfolio. So Dave, thank you very much. We do wish you and Carthona the best, and we thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your knowledge. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
Enjoy. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers.